For the week of September 25th, 2011, this is Showbiz Sandbox episode 120, the podcast that brings you all the dirt on the news making headlines around the entertainment world. In Los Angeles, I'm Jay Sperling Reich.
And from the sweltering Amazon warehouse in Lehigh Valley, Pennsylvania, I'm Michael Giltz.
What are you doing in Lehigh, Pennsylvania?
I'm joking. There was a big expose in a newspaper, in an Allentown newspaper in Pennsylvania, where my brother lives, actually, about an Amazon warehouse where they do one of their big distribution centers. And it was going well over 100 degrees there, apparently, over the summer. People were dropping like flies. I'm not exaggerating. Amazon had ambulances and medical personnel on standby to help the people who they knew were going to collapse. If you have to have ambulances on standby, something's wrong. And this paper did a great article. It's a very extensive piece. They interviewed dozens of people. It was a really good article. Amazon has now spent a couple million dollars on air conditioning. This warehouse is very different from their others. This is the only one where we've seen this sort of problem. But they've now been forced to take appropriate action instead of just pushing their employees to work harder and harder and longer and ignoring their pleas that they're collapsing from heat exhaustion. But I just really wanted to mention, just because I thought this is the sort of article that we're going to lose as local newspapers disappear around the country.
Well, now, speaking of problems, it's good that Amazon has fixed their problem. And we fixed a problem last week with our feed. For some reason, our feed did not update and our podcast was finally put onto iTunes. I think it was on Thursday.
That's bad even for us.
I mean, I don't know what was going on there with FeedBurner, but we apologize and it's been fixed and it seems to be working fine now. Today's show, however, will go up immediately after we're done recording, and on today's show, we'll be talking to Ryan Lawler of GigaOhm. He's going to be joining us to talk about what the heck is going on with Netflix, as well as what's going on with Dish Networks and their plans for Blockbuster. At movie theaters, you know those places you go to watch movies when you're not streaming them on Netflix? We'll tell you why E.T. in 3D may actually be a reality in the years to come. Music giant Live Nation got a little bigger last week after announcing a deal with Universal Music Group. We'll tell you what that all means. Publishing and book news, we've got tons of that too. Of course, we'll cover all the big entertainment headlines during Big Deal or Big Whoop. And we'll end with some correspondence from listeners. But first, as always, we turn it over to entertainment journalist extraordinaire Michael Giltz, who's been at the New York Film Festival all week, or at least screenings for it. He's going to fill us in on the weekend's box office.
Well, the number one movie around the world last week was, in fact, Star Wars.
What?
That's right. Star Wars Saga came out on Blu-ray. All six films came out on Blu-ray for the first time. If you look at all the sales around the world, they grossed $84 million last week. That would make it by far the biggest movie in the world if it was at the box office. It was a huge hit. It shows how much Blu-ray has come into its own. They sold more than a million copies. And it shows the value catalogs still have for studios, which brings us to our number one film at the box office worldwide. When you add up all the movie business around the world, the number one movie at the box office this weekend was, of course, The Lion King 3D, which held off a new film by Brad Pitt, a new family film that was a surprise hit, and other movies released around the world. So a movie that came out decades ago is now the number one movie at the box office for two weekends in a row. It grossed $24 million. It's now at $862 million worldwide. It's just behind Finding Nemo and within striking distance of an Ice Age sequel to become the third highest grossing animated film of all time. And it still has 60% of the world market to open in. So it should pass them and really, you know, continue to rack up the records.
Well, now, you know, when The Lion King was released on video, home video, it was VHS, of course, in 1995. And I think it sold like 16 million units in the first week or the first month. I can't remember exactly, but it was some astronomical number. So I find it interesting. You know, Star Wars sets this Blu-ray record, but it's really a million copies is nothing when you think about it.
It is because it's a six movie set. It's not a one movie. It's six different films all pulled together.
Yeah, that's true.
So that's a substantial investment for people. And it's a movie they already probably own on DVD. So they're just upgrading in sound and picture quality to a new format for which they need to own a new player, you know.
Good point. Yeah, so what you're saying is that buying a $16 VHS tape is not the same as buying a $150 six-movie combo pack.
Exactly.
Yeah.
It did come out in 95. It sold 4.5 million copies on the first day it came out.
Yeah.
And its total sales were more than 30 million before it went into moratorium in 1997, of course. And then, of course, they put it out on DVD in 2003 and all that.
Right.
So it's a wildly popular film. I'm surprised at how well it's done at the box office, but, you know, more power to them. Animated films are the easiest to convert to 3D. They
have
the
big,
especially modern ones. They have the biggest impact. They work the best. And it's obviously already one of the most popular films of all time. So there's a natural demand to see it in a big screen.
That is very true.
Did you take your kids to see it? I forget.
I have not, no.
Is it? It just feels like it's not a template for every other movie in the world, but we'll get to that a little bit later. The number two movie at the box office around the world was Moneyball, the baseball movie starring Brad Pitt. It grossed $20.6 million. Basically, it opened in North America only, where you expect most of its business will be because it's about baseball.
Right.
The number one, three movie around the world is Dolphin Tale, a family film, also opening in North America. It grossed $20.2 million, just a smidgen behind Moneyball. The number four movie at the box office worldwide continues to be The Smurfs, which has been number one overseas for 7 weeks in a row. It's really racking up money. It grossed $12.9 million around the globe. It's at $500 million worldwide and counting. So a movie that did so-so in North America has really exploded overseas. $500 million is a very good pull for a movie that cost about $100 million to make. Add in DVD sales, which tend to be stronger for family films. This is now definitely a success story, and there will certainly be a sequel.
I'm already in line for Smurfs too.
At number five is Abduction, the film starring Taylor Lautner from the Twilight movies. It grossed $11.2 million worldwide, basically in North America only. And number six is Friends with Benefits, which grossed $9.7 million worldwide, and it's at $111 million and counting. And number seven is Killer Elite, which opened in North America. It grossed $9.5 million. And number eight is Contagion, which grossed $8.5 million. It's basically out in North America only. It's hit $57 million and counting. And number nine is Johnny English Reborn, the James Bond spoof, which opened overseas. It's grossed $7.4 million. And number 10, Final Destination 5, continues to make money, $6.6 million. It's at $137 million worldwide and counting. And number 11 is sort of an interesting take, a big smash opening for a South Korean film called Silenced. It grossed $6.2 million in its country. It's an intense drama based on the true story of violent events at a rural school for the hearing impaired, which sounds upsetting and awful. I'm not sure if it's more of a horror or a thriller or what kind of a film it is. But,
well, this is also from the same country where that gave us Thirst.
That's right. So that country has a good track record in the last few years of very influential horror films. This might be more of a serious drama. I don't know. But it sounds like a movie we're going to be hearing more from and perhaps see a remake. At number 12 is Crazy Stupid Love, the Steve Carell film, $6.2 million worldwide. It's at $117 million and counting. Rise of the Planet of the Apes is at number 13. It grossed another $5.8 million, and it's now past $400 million worldwide and counting. At number 14 is Ryan Gosling in Drive, the thriller that's sort of an 80s throwback. It grossed $5.7 million. It's at $21 million total to date. And at number 15 is The Help, which grossed $4.4 million. It's at $161 million worldwide, with a lot of overseas markets to come. And domestically, we saw some other films fading fast. Straw Dogs, the Sarah Jessica Parker film, I Don't Know How She Does It, both collapsed in their second week, dropping by more than 50%. And the Helen Mirren thriller, The Debt, is almost done. It's at $28 million total.
Well, it was the highest grossing September weekend on record.
Wow, really? And that's thanks to a movie that's more than 20 years old.
That's right.
30. Yeah, I mean, that's kind of... Lion King is almost 30 years old, I guess.
And Moneyball launched 94% on Rotten Tomatoes. So critics love it. Audiences really seem to like it. So that should have some legs. It should do rather well. But then, you know, that stars Brad Pitt, a big movie star. Taylor Lautner was banked as the, you know, movie star of tomorrow. His movie Abduction opens and doesn't really open. It opens to $11 million.
Well, you know, Taylor Lautner's not a movie star yet. They're hoping he is, but all he's been in are the Twilight movies. Robert Pattinson's made about a dozen movies. None of them have done well except the Twilight movies. So it's not easy. I don't think Taylor Lautner got particularly bad reviews, so this may not be his fault, but it's just not a very good movie. Moneyball, however, I did see. I'm surprised it's that high on Rotten Tomatoes. I was not that impressed by it. I think it will fall fast because it's not an entertaining film. It's a very flat, unemotional movie. There's not a lot to dig into. I don't think it's a real crowd pleaser. Brad Pitt hasn't been a huge pull at the box office outside the Ocean's 11 movies. I'm surprised how well it opened, given that it's about baseball and it stars Brad Pitt. I think this is a terrific opening. It did get good reviews. I don't think it will have that long legs, but, you know, I've been wrong before. But we'll have to see how it pans out. For a lot of reasons, I thought it didn't work. But I sort of enjoyed seeing the movie because I'm a big baseball fan. But does this mean we'll be seeing more movies like The Lion King coming to the box office?
Lion King is a big surprise to most people that it's done so well 20 plus years after it was first released. I guess it's not 20 years. It's like, what, 14, 16?
I'm confused. When did it come out?
1994.
Wow, it sure came fast to Broadway. I mean, we've had Broadway and straight to DVD sequels. You're right. It's 1994. It's not even 20 years old. It's a 17-year-old movie.
Well, and it couldn't have come at a better time because here in Hollywood last week was the 3D Entertainment Summit. This is an annual conference where, you know, everything about 3D is discussed, and our friend James Cameron was there talking about his little project. But really, what this means is we're going to be seeing more and more films, archival titles, so movies like Star Wars, Titanic, Top Gun, hit movie theaters in 3D.
Well, I think this is a very limited phenomenon. We've already seen Titanic. You know, it's been in the works for a while. Star Wars and It both come out in early 2012. They are two of the biggest properties of all time. You know,
right.
You say that Titanic is coming out in 3D. Well, all right. He's spending $18 million. He's taking a long time to do it. It's still a little bit of a gamble. He'll probably make his money back, but who knows if it will revitalize the film. But this doesn't mean we're going to see, you know, spectacle movies suddenly being churned out in 3D.
So you don't think Stand By Me is going to be like a big, you know, draw on after they spend $10 million to upgrade it to 3D?
Right. I think Top Gun is a big risk. I wouldn't spend the money to do that.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you pointed out that animation is easier to convert to 3D than, say, live action. And that's very true. And Cameron was talking about how he's spending $18 million in more than a year and how every single shot of the film now becomes this laborious visual effects project. And actually, this is a really good take. We were talking last week about how much it costs and what needs to be done to convert a film to 3D. And in a Los Angeles Times piece, here's a quote. It says, a process that effectively makes every shot of the more than three-hour movie a laborious visual effects project, which I just said. For instance, if Cameron digitally moves Leonardo DiCaprio's and Kate Winslet's faces farther apart to create depth on screen, it creates a blank spot behind them that needs to be painted to match the pink-orange sunset in the rest of the frame.
So those are some of the technical difficulties you reach.
Yeah, I mean, you basically are isolating objects and then moving them around the screen. But when you move them, you're actually leaving nothing in its place.
So what does that cost to deal with?
Well, last week I said $1,000 a minute, and I think I meant second because it used to cost $100,000 a minute, and now it's closer to $25,000 a minute. Thanks.
And
to
is that for the James Cameron level technical care, or is that just the basic process?
That's the basic process. I think for Top Gun, they're probably spending $25,000 to $30,000 a minute, and for James Cameron, I mean, he's not only dimensionalizing it and going and making everything 3D, but he's probably post-processing all of the images so that you can't tell where the 3D holes are. And so he's probably over at Lowry Digital right now just painting every single frame of that film.
Well, here's what I think. I think animated films work really well in 3D. We know that. Obviously, people came out to see The Lion King in 3D. That was the draw. We don't know what would have happened if they had just re-released the film in 2D. Probably not nearly as much attention, I guess. I'm loath to say it, but I think it's true. However, and then there's a long history in Hollywood of re-releasing movies. Sound of Music used to be released over and over, Gone with the Wind. You know, this was before movies were available for home video purchase.
That's right.
And they made lots of money at it, and it's great. And the best way to see a movie is in a movie theater, you know, in nice seats, great picture, great sound. The only thing that bothers me is that you have to pay top dollar and see it in a way it was never meant to be seen.
Yeah, I mean, that's really the argument that many film historians are making, is that it's bad for the film itself. I mean, you might make more money, but that, you know, as far as filmmaking goes, it's just not a good practice.
Yeah, and you see it, even 2D movies are coming out to the theater. Sony is going to re-release Ghostbusters in October. And you think, really? Wow. Well, you know, I love Ghostbusters. I think it's one of the funniest comedies around. Certainly one of the funniest special effects comedies, if there is such a genre of the sort of big spectacle comedies, which is a very weird, hard thing to do. This is probably the best of all time. And I look into the details, though, and it's not that big a deal. They're releasing it in October for one showing a week on one night. So basically every Thursday in October, you can go to a primetime screening of Ghostbusters at your local theater. They're putting in about 500 screens around the country. And you think, well, what's the point of that? Why spend the money to re-release Ghostbusters for one screening one night a week?
Well, aren't they trying to make Ghostbusters 3 or trying to convince the cast to come back for Ghostbusters 3? I think that might be why they're doing this.
Well, they are. They've always wanted to get Bill Murray to commit to Ghostbusters 3. I think Dan Aykroyd is on board. Harold Ramis certainly isn't busy. And I think they're ready to do that. He's never been happy with the script, I don't think. And they've been talking now even recently about John Hodgman from The Daily Show as maybe stepping in for Bill Murray if they do a sequel without him.
Oh, he's hilarious. But
he is hilarious. He would fit in the Ghostbusters world, I think, as another sidekick is what I would do. I would not replace Bill Murray if he's willing to do it, obviously. But, you know, if you're trying to convince them it's a good idea, one night a week for 4 weeks is not really going to bring in big bucks and wow people.
No, but what the exhibitors are trying to do, the movie theater owners, is they're trying to get more people in on a Thursday night.
Well, I thought Tuesday was always the lowest night of the week because that was always the night where they had dollar days and
it absolutely
deals.
Is. You're absolutely right. But, you know, it doesn't hurt to get a few more butts in seats on Thursday evening.
Is that what they're trying to do? Is that why theater owners are happy it's on a Thursday? I mean, obviously Friday, Saturday, Sunday wouldn't work.
No, it wouldn't, because that would gut the studio's current product.
But it's now will be almost impossible to tell how well the movie's doing. It's not going to be a proper launch. You can't go opening weekend to see it. It's just going to be on a Thursday.
And that might be why they're doing it that way. That very well might be. But, you know, last week the question arose, how much does it cost to convert these films? The answer, around $10 million per film.
Depending on how long they are.
Correct, yes. But really, this was not a week about movie news, in my opinion.
Really?
No, I think this was a week of television news, not only because the season, the new television season launched, the fall season, but because of what happened on CBS and Comedy Central.
Talk to me.
Did you know that Charlie Sheen is no longer a part of Two and a Half Men, which was the highest rated sitcom last year?
Yes, and now it's even highest rated. the new season debuted with Ashton Kutcher in the place of Charlie Sheen. It drew a record 28.7 million viewers. It's the biggest episode ever in that series, one of the biggest episodes ever for a sitcom. It was just a massive, massive hit night where people wanted to see how they'd get rid of Charlie Sheen and how they'd bring in Ashton Kutcher. And the roast of Charlie Sheen, which aired on Comedy Central, also did very well. It set a record for that franchise. It drew 6.4 million viewers. So everybody's happy. Charlie Sheen made nice on the Emmys. The new season of Two and a Half Men got off to a blast. Obviously, numbers will fall way back down, but there's every possibility it might maintain the levels of last year, which would be a big success for a show that's 8 years into its run.
Yeah, I mean, if they get 12 to 14 million people watching it per week, that's actually pretty good.
Well, that'd make it a top 10 show.
Right. Now, did you see the episode in which Ashton Kutcher replaced Charlie Sheen?
I did.
And what did you think?
You know, I've never been a fan of the show. I wasn't a fan of the episode. It was okay. He's a slightly different spin on the Charlie Sheen character. He's a eccentric billionaire dude who's got a broken heart. So he beds women easily, just like Charlie Sheen. But he's nice and he's rich and he's sort of sweet rather than rapacious, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, I kind of watched it and went, wow, I hope they do better than this. The whole episode started with a 5-minute funeral scene in which they just tore Charlie Sheen apart.
Well, no, they didn't. They made fun of the character. They weren't mocking Charlie Sheen. It was totally in keeping with the show and what it is and that character. You know, his old girlfriend saying, you know, the Charlie Sheen character gave me syphilis or whatever. It's just the bad writing of the show, but it's been like that for 8 years if you ever watch it.
Yeah, that's true. But, you know, it gave a great lead-in to Two Broke Girls. 19 million people watched that.
Right, that's a new show that looks to be one of the big success stories for CBS. Obviously, it got sampled by that big audience, but it has always been the most highly praised sitcom, I think, and the one everybody picks to be a good hit because it's so well-placed between, you know, How I Met Your Mother and Two and a Half Men. It's just a really good time slot for that show.
Yeah, well, the other big news of the week was probably finally the debut and premiere of The X Factor.
The X Factor debuted. It was had strong ratings, but it was disappointing because it was not a blockbuster the way many people anticipated it might be. That's a sigh of relief, I think, for American Idol people. However, the thing that makes this show different will be coming in the later episodes when the judges mentor and work with the groups. You know, that's where the real difference. If you watch the first week, it felt very much like American Idol with a few twists. But I think more and more as the weeks go on, you'll see it's a fairly, you know, substantially different twist on the format. We'll have to see how that works down the road. But the good news, you know, is that it was a successful launch.
12 million people watched it.
That's right. And the second episode held well. CBS had a very good week with almost all its shows getting sampled. Everybody had shows that debuted and people are watching them. People are checking them out. Pan Am on ABC opened nicely on Sunday night. The Secret Circle on the CW, which is a network in freefall, that got strong sampling. It looks like everybody has, you know, a good debut week where people tuned in and they watched and they saw what shows were out there and how they were doing.
Well, now, did you actually watch The X Factor, which is kind of a take on American Idol? Simon Cowell, the judge on American Idol, and I guess the producer of American Idol, has moved on to The X Factor, and he was hoping for 20 million viewers. He didn't get it. Did you watch it?
Yeah, of course. Yeah, I watched it.
And what did you think?
I found it sort of weirdly edited. I wasn't thrilled with it, but you know what? In night two, there was a girl who's 18 or 19, a college student, who sang Listen by Beyonce and was 1,000 times better than everybody else and just blew me away. I thought she gave a full, complete performance. I thought, wow, that is really, you know, that was a performance you would see in concert and not blink twice about. It was it wasn't an audition. It was a great performance of that song. And the way she sang it and how she approached it, she felt like somebody who is the real deal. And she's not a beauty in the sense that you look at her and she's already glammed out. She looks like she'll have a great makeover. You'll be able to watch that happen to her where she become more and more glamorous. And she had a little look at the end of the song where like, uh-huh, I nailed it. That look of determination that hungry people who want to become stars have. And the audience went crazy, of course, as it did for a few other people. But
yeah, there are a number of contestants on the first year's X Factor that really are in need of makeovers. And I think that's probably why they were picked.
I don't know what you mean.
Well, there's the homeless man. There's the drug addict. There's the, you know, so there's all these people that kind of have this checkered background that were selected to move on.
Well, the sob stories have always been a part of American Idol and the X Factor. I'm saying her physical look, the way she dressed. I'm not talking about their checkered lives. I'm talking about just, you know, how she looked. She was not dressed to the nines. Some of them come out and they're already have a look and they look really hot. She didn't have that, but she's an attractive young woman and she will blossom just like, say, Kelly Clarkson. So, you know, you watch the show, you see somebody who's really talented. That's what it's all about.
And I was watching it and trying to find what makes this different from American Idol. The X Factor, at least in its first two nights, looked exactly like American Idol.
Well, that's what it is. It was a ripoff. That's why American Idol sued and why they got their settlement, you know, back when it launched in the UK. But it is different later in the later episodes where the judges mentor. It's a format that's been ripped off by other shows like The Sing-Off. So we'll have to see how it all plays out.
Well, and The Sing-Off is not doing very well now. But what do you think of L.A. Reid as one of the judges? We've seen Paula Abdul be a judge.
I can't believe you're talking this much about The X Factor. You, who would never watch an episode of American Idol, are suddenly getting all Karen Woodward on me.
Oh, well, come on. I mean, it's how much publicity did we see about this beforehand?
Never stopped you on Idol. It's the number one show in the country. The big negatives on the show is not L.A. Reid. He was a little bland, but they're trying to set up the idea that he and Simon have a little bit of difference of opinion and a little may butt heads. The real news was Nicole Scherzinger, the girl from the Pussycat Dolls who replaced Cheryl Cole. She's terrible on that show that she did, you know, with the a cappella groups. She was incredibly boring on that show for two seasons as a judge. Just put you to sleep. She's equally boring here. She's an absolute dull personality. How bad must Cheryl Cole have been to replace her with Nicole? I don't know.
Well, I think really it was nobody could understand her. I mean, as she was speaking, I thought, wait, this must be the person they replaced because I can't understand a word she's saying.
Maybe so, but they should have found somebody better than Nicole. We've already seen her for 2 years be a judge. She's incredibly bland and dull. Paula may have been nice to people, but she was always wacky and offbeat. Nicole clearly is always polite to the guests. L.A. Reid made a joke where he said something like, well, you always like everybody. What do you think about him? You know, and the one point where she said, there's room for improvement, Simon Cowell said, wow, coming from her, that's not good. So she's apparently the queen of, you know, dullness as far as this show is concerned. I think she's just awful. But we'll have to see how she does when it's a live show and she's interacting with the contestants. So it's a long way to go.
Well, another story we couldn't get away from last year or over the past year was this whole Charlie Sheen thing. We've already talked about the roast and Two and a Half Men's new character and its debut. But it looks like this lawsuit between Charlie Sheen and Warner Brothers, the production company behind Two and a Half Men, it's going to be settled for about $25 million.
Well, that's according to the LA Times, so we'll have to see when it becomes official. But yes, this is why Charlie Sheen went on and did his tour of contritement and played nice on the Emmy Awards. Everybody's going to drop their lawsuits. Chuck Lorre, Warner Brothers, Charlie Sheen. Everybody drops every lawsuit. And he's going to get a lump sum payment of $25 million, which reflects the profit participation he would have enjoyed if he was still working on the show. You know, they filed a $100 million lawsuit against Warner Brothers, but lawyers like to name big numbers. What we expected and predicted all along, that he had a very good case. How are you going to argue this guy is not capable of doing the job? What was new this season that you suddenly had to dump him after all these years? You know, they were going to have a terrible time of it. It was all going to get out in public. And this, I think, reflects it. $25 million is a lot of money.
That's right. Yeah. I mean, it's a quarter of what they were asking for. But still, I think they were asking for a lot so that when negotiations
started.
Yeah, you always start high. Yeah.
But, you know, it's just, you know, I mean, it's complicated. We took people to task over Amy Winehouse and how people booked her when she was on tour and clearly not capable of performing. So why don't we hold Warner Brothers to task on this? You know, it's very hard. You're not the master or the owner of these people. You know, you have an ethical obligation to try and step in and behave responsibly. But at some point, people are responsible for their own actions. You know, he was making the show. He was delivering the goods. You know, you can't just dump him and pretend it's suddenly some moral outrage when it's something else.
Now, speaking of getting dumped, I guess that's not really the right word here, but over in music news, a band broke up after 31 years, R.E.M. Are you a fan of them?
Well, I have been. Certainly, some of their albums are among my favorites of all time. I mean, Murmur and Life's Rich Pageant and Automatic for the People, especially, I think, are their three masterpieces for me. They were a great band. When their drummer left the band many, many years ago, that was Bill Berry. I think that was in 96 or 7. When he left, they should have called it a day. Nothing much that they've done since then has been up to their snuff. They've had good songs. They've had good this and that. But the last, you know, 15 years mostly has been pretty thin stuff.
Yeah, and so he left not because of any big dispute, but because he had a brain aneurysm. He had a life-threatening moment in his life. And afterwards, he said, you know what? I think maybe I'll just take it easy and become a farmer.
And that's right. And, you know, it was fine for them to go move on, but they just didn't do a very good job. You know, Up, Reveal, Around the Sun, Accelerate, Collapse into Now. None of these albums are very good. You know, and they got more and more defensive as the years went on about their output and how, well, if you weren't judging us by the fact that we're REM, you'd say this album was brilliant. It's like, no, we wouldn't. You know, some bands like the Talking Heads know when to call it a day. And that's unbelievable. It's so hard to walk away.
Well, they also had a pretty contentious relationship in that band, as witnessed by, you know, what's happened since they broke up.
Well, sure. But, you know, but nonetheless, they could have felt drawn to get back together, tour, do stuff to make money, have a 20th anniversary commercial tour, do this, that, the other thing. People break up and get back together all the time. Just like with television shows, it's very hard to know when to end something that's a success. REM, you know, it's about a decade too late, but... You know, they've had a great run. It doesn't take away from what a great act they've been.
Right. And bassist Mike Mills kind of says exactly what you're saying here. He says, quote, "There's no disharmony here, no falling outs, no lawyers squaring off. We've made this decision together amicably and with each other's best interests at heart. The time just feels right." Although Ethan Kaplan, who is the owner of a fan community called Murmurs, so he's kind of an REM fan club head. And he's also a former senior vice president of emerging technology over at Warner Brother Records. He said that the band's decision was influenced in part by all of the politics that are going on at labels.
Yeah, I thought this was bizarre. He said, "I suspected this was coming last fall." That's what he told Rolling Stone. "If you remember, they weathered a lot of storms in this business and have always operated on their own terms. Warner Brothers changed starting last September. And I think the demands on a band now to get a record out were more than they might have wanted to commit. I can understand that after how hard they've worked for how long, the thought of going back to quote unquote paying dues with new label staff in a very weird industry was too much."
Well, you know what? Here's what you do. You just dump your label and you release stuff on your own.
Yeah, I mean, exactly. That's what I would have said. No, it's not that Warner Brothers made them quit or, oh, I can't deal with the new management. They wanted to just do it their own way. They'd do it like a lot of other people and do it themselves.
Right, because they certainly have a name.
But that's a pain in the neck, of course, and they didn't want the hassle. I think they really realized creatively that their day had passed quite a while ago and it was time to hang it up.
Right. I mean, I wonder if you see Michael Stipe, who is their lead singer, REM's lead singer, whether he goes off and has a solo career of some kind.
Well, of course, they'll all continue being creators. They're not going to just sit at home.
Right.
He's always been involved in film and other stuff. I'm sure he'll release a solo album. I hope it's sort of interestingly different, or who knows? Maybe it'll be the REM album we've been waiting for 10 or 20 years.
Well, now, what did you make of this news about Live Nation, which is the owner of Ticketmaster now, And they also kind of have this management company, this 360 management company, where they manage your touring, your albums, your whole career. And they teamed up with Universal Music Group's management end of things. What did you make of all that?
Well, I mean, Universal had sort of bought this management company when they got Sanctuary, and they thought maybe they'd become a 360 company just like Live Nation and, you know, do everything, tours, merchandising, everything, label, music, the whole shebang, just like Live Nation is doing. And I think they realized that they can't really change that much, and that's not really their strength, and they just need to focus on music. And so they're sort of passing it on to Live Nation, letting them take over this end of what they own and try to partner with them.
Right, forming this joint venture, which, I mean, when you think about it, you've got ZZ Top, The Who, Robert Plant, Judas Priest, Fleetwood Mac, The Eagles, Aerosmith, Christina Aguilera, Jimmy Buffett, Neil Diamond, all under one roof, among many, many others.
Yeah, and it's just a thing where they're going to package together. Pardon me. I beg your pardon, people. Some people have children listening. Package stuff together, including concert tickets with DVDs and albums and all that stuff and a t-shirt. You know, it's just the same old we've been hearing about for a while. But Universal said, you know what? It's too much of a hassle. We can't. That's not our world. We're not going to try and learn all that.
Right.
Let Live Nation handle it.
Right. The margins are higher on recorded music anyway, whereas management, you know, you're squeaking out these little margins, these small margins. And they say that they will focus on developing direct-to-consumer bundling initiatives for select UMG artists in key markets around the world that bring together concert tickets and a variety of music products with artists' websites. Now, my thought on this ultimately was, gee, you've got these websites and these platforms like Nimbit, like Topspin, that are allowing artists to do just that, where an artist can sign up and they can control everything from selling the album directly to a fan to selling tickets directly to fans to selling t-shirts and everything. So effectively, they're just taking on these smaller players, and smaller in regard to they're not multi-billion dollar record companies or million dollar management firms. They are web startups, and they're just doing the same exact thing because Nimbit and Topspin have found some success.
I'm confused by that. I mean, I don't think Nimbit and Topspin work with people like ZZ Top or Fleetwood Mac.
Yeah, they do. They work with Elvis Costello. They've worked with Paul McCartney. They've worked with some huge names. In fact, Topspin, for a while, you couldn't get on Topspin unless you were a huge name.
Really?
Yeah.
It just seems to me like it's bad news for fans because it just means more and more acts handled by fewer and fewer people. Live Nation gets bigger. The big record labels get bigger. They're all just consuming everything, and there's just fewer alternatives for fans. They're, you know, everybody's going to these bigger and bigger conglomerates. Just music is not where it's at, and the industry's drying up, and everything's getting consolidated into a few big firms.
Well, certainly an industry in transition is the whole book industry. If you think music is in transition, books are, I mean, in my opinion, the whole world is changing in that industry. And I know you have a whole bunch of news here that you want to share, including some new copyright law, which is coming into effect in 2013. What exactly is this?
Well, we've been talking for a while about copyright laws affecting music. Albums released in 1978 or later, according to the U.S. copyright law, can revert back to the artist after 35 years.
Right, that's called termination rights.
Right, and that's in 2013, but you start processing your claims in 2011. And so it's been an article in the New York Times, and everybody in the industry is talking about it. What we didn't grasp at first was that this copyright law also affects publishing. So just as with the music business, it's creating a lot of turmoil in the publishing industry. And I'm just starting to see articles in Publishers Weekly where they say, yeah, looks like the law is going to apply. If you create the novel, just like the musician creates the album, you know, starting now, you can start to get the termination rights and pull that book back and own it yourself rather than own it, rather than have the publisher own it.
So in a way, it could be good for authors, although they would have to find a way to market it.
That's right. I mean, you know, it's getting easier and easier to market yourself because, you know, you get it on Kindle. Well, there, by God, if they type in your name, they'll find it. But, you know, it's kind of crazy. There was an article saying that in the Publishers Weekly that January 1st, 2013 could be doomsday for publishing.
Doomsday? Doomsday, really?
Well, if they start losing all their books, the publishing industry always makes all their money on backlog. They don't make money on current hits. You know, you publish 100 books and maybe one of them is a hit if you're lucky. So the catalog is where they've always made their money. And now they find the prices being pushed down by ebooks, and they find authors reclaiming their titles and putting them out themselves, which is easier to do than ever. Yeah, that could be a very scary situation. Attorney Lloyd Jassen told Publishers Weekly, quote, "Does this have the ability to harm the bottom line of the Big Six? Without question." End quote. And with Amazon looming as an ideal partner for authors who want to become publishers, Amazon makes it as easier to do than ever. You know, it's just, it opens up a huge opportunity.
Well, who's the opportunity for?
Well, if you look back at the bestsellers since 1978, as I did, some of the big hit titles that were released that year were James Michener with Chesapeake, Herman Woke, whose book War and Remembrance was a sequel to The Winds of War, and Ken Follett, whose book Eye of the Needle came out that year, made a very good film in 1982 or three. I read that book actually when it came out. And in nonfiction, you had Irma Bombeck, the comedian, whose book If Life is a Bowl of Cherries, What Am I Doing in the Pits? I read that as well. Mommy Dearest by Christina Crawford, a memoir by Richard Nixon, which was a big bestseller. And historian Barbara Tuchman, whose book, A Distant Mirror, was about, I think, the 14th century, what life was like then. She's one of my favorite historians. I've always been meaning to read this book. I've never gotten around to it. You know what? If it got released in an ebook at a cheap price, I might just snap it up.
Yeah, well, I mean, these are also, you know, Ken Follett is not exactly an unknown. I mean, he's got a following, and Herman Woke,
yeah,
likewise.
These are all brand names. I focused on the brand name authors and, you know, and titles. These are all big, big bestsellers from 1978. They still have a lot of currency, you know, Ken Follett, certainly James Michener. So they're very valuable properties for publishers.
Yeah, I mean, I guess I just wonder, you know, you talked about this opportunity being out there, but if you're Mr. No-Name Author, you know, how is it an opportunity for you? You're still going to have to market the heck out of yourself.
If you're a no-name author, your book has gone out of print and the rights have reverted to you anyway. We're talking about the books that are still valuable. Those are the books that publishers keep in print, and those are the books they make money on, and those are the books that they might lose the rights to. I think it's a big deal.
Oh, really? Well, then it must be time for Big Deal or Big Whoop, our segment where we discuss the top entertainment news stories of the week and decide whether they are a big deal or if anyone should care about them. It turns out Pandora is coming to Disney World. That's right, the blue planet envisioned by director James Cameron in his film Avatar is coming to Disney World. Construction will begin in 2013 on a themed, quote-unquote, land that will likely be set in Animal Kingdom, which makes sense given the movie's ecological theme, but it's just the first step in a massive deal which will surely include flying rides to mimic Jake's ride on the Taruk? Is that how you pronounce that?
I'm not sure. I've only seen the movie once.
Underwater rides linked to the next film and countless other possibilities, all of it using state-of-the-art technology. Is this a big deal or a big whoop, Michael?
I think it's a very big deal. Disney's the premier theme park around the world. They've got them, you know, everywhere in Europe, in Asia, and this is a huge commitment to Avatar. I know it's the biggest film of all time, but wow. You know, to commit to this much of a permanent presence in Disney World, this stage when there's still a second and third film to come out. You know, remember The Matrix? That first movie looked cool as all get out. Then 2 and 3 come out and you go, that's not so cool. But it makes great sense. James Cameron loves technology. It's a really good partnership. If you're going to get your stuff in a theme park, you want it to be a Disney World, and it works for everybody. It's older. It's boys. You know, boys love sci-fi. I think it's going to appeal to boys more than girls, perhaps. It fits in with Disney's theme of ecology and be good to the environment. It's going to be all over their parks, and it's a significant deal. It's as big a deal as when they bought the Muppets, I think. And the Muppets, they never really made as much use of, and I think this is really going to have a much bigger impact on their parks.
I would agree with you on that.
You know, speaking of Pandora, when you said it at the beginning of the article, I thought the streaming music company is coming to Disney World. What are you talking about? But of course, you meant Pandora from Avatar.
That's right. Well, you know, funny, Michael, but actually, Pandora, the music company, is in the news as well. The latest feature they're adding to the popular music streaming service. Well, guess what? It's tour dates. Pandora already knows what your favorite acts are. Now it can cross-reference all your info with upcoming tours and offer you quick and easy info about when your favorite acts are coming to town and links to buy tickets. You get a heads up on concerts in your area. Pandora gets a tiny commission. Is the future twist on Pandora a big deal or a big whoop, Michael?
Well, it makes sense. It hasn't happened yet. It's not a service that they've launched. It's just one that they're talking about. But
right, yeah.
It's such a natural fit that it, you know, makes sense. As long as you don't do it in a way that feels intrusive and people say, yes, I want to know when X number of acts or all my acts are coming to town, then it could be good. If you get deluged with stuff and you feel like they're creepily telling you stuff that you don't really want them to know, even though you've already told them, then it can backfire.
Well, right. Of course, they're collecting your zip code so they know where you live. And there was a little controversy over their iPhone app, which was tracking where you've been. So, you know, it had all of the places geolocation-wise of where you've been. So as long as they're not kind of in intruding on your privacy, I think they'll be fine. Of course, they're going up against Songkick, which is a popular service that does just this. It warns you of upcoming concerts for acts that you say you like.
Right, but this, you don't have to fill in any information. It's done for you. If you already have Pandora, you don't have to go to Songkick, and you wouldn't bother anymore.
That's right.
If it worked just as well, because it's already in there, so great.
Right. Amazon's tablet will be announced on Wednesday, but it's not so great news for publishers. Those who thought Amazon could be a reasonable alternative to Apple's iPad were delighted to hear that Amazon wouldn't demand 30% of sales. Indeed, they want 40%. Now they've backed down to 30%, will be more forthcoming with customer contact info and the like, and publishers, especially magazines, hope the tablet will be their shining hope. Is the new Amazon tablet a big deal or a big whoop?
Well, clearly it's a big deal. I can't wait to get the news on it. There's talk that they're going to pair it with cloud storage so that all your stuff, not just your books, will be stored in the cloud. You'll be allowed to store personal documents in the cloud, which you can download them onto your Kindle, but it's slightly complicated, but everything will be easier. It'll be linked to Amazon Prime. You'll have more TV shows and music and movies and books. Everything will be going through this tablet. So it's a big deal. But it's interesting to hear them playing hardball and saying, yeah, we want 30% of sales. Really? Wow.
Yeah, well, they wanted 40% originally.
Well, that's the bargaining. That's how it works. And now people go, thank God they only want 30% of our sales.
Well, and you know, they announced last week the library lending of books. So now you can...
Yeah, for the Kindle, exactly. Yeah. So the Kindle and the tablet, it'll be very interesting to see if people get disappointed by the 7-inch screen because it's a little smaller than the tablet, or whether they find it wonderfully portable.
Yeah, we'll see what they announce. Tony Bennett finally makes it big.
Thank God. I've been rooting for him for years.
Yes, after 6 decades in the entertainment business, singer Tony Bennett will finally top the Billboard charts with his new album, Duets 2. It pairs the crooner with current singers like the late Amy Winehouse, Carrie Underwood, K.D. Lang, and Lady Gaga, and sold more than 170,000 copies in its first week, putting it at number one. Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
It's a big deal. God bless him. It just shows low music sales, obviously, that 170,000 could top the Billboard charts. But, you know, I'm a big fan of Tony Bennett. However, if you don't own any Tony Bennett album and you're thinking of buying one, for God's sakes, don't make it Duets or Duets 2. Go back into his catalog and make it, you know, live at Carnegie Hall or Tony Bennett and Bill Evans or When Lights Are Low or I Left My Heart in San Francisco. Or if you want something more recent, his duet album with K.D. Lang or his tribute to Frank Sinatra, anything. You know, do not start with these horrendous pop collaborations. Frank Sinatra did them. Tony Bennett did them. They're awful. Stay away.
He's 85 years old.
Well, he can still sing. God bless him. You know, he's still got it. So he's not done musically and creatively, but these duets albums are not it.
The company behind The X Factor, Fremantle, has responded to the lawsuit filed by American Idol executive producer Simon Fuller, who claims a deal they all made promised him an executive producer credit and, of course, lots of money, if and when The X Factor ever came to America. Fremantle's response? That's not our letter. Fremantle says the letter brokering an agreement came from Fox, not Fremantle, and if Fuller thinks he has a lawsuit, he should be suing Fox, not them. Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
I thought this was hilarious. They're like, what? We got that letter, but it wasn't from us. That was just an amazing legal thing, just totally stepping away and saying, that ain't our letter. Why do you think we didn't agree to that? We just received a copy of it. I don't know how that's going to play out in court, but it's a fascinating move. You know, I think American Idol is breathing a sigh of relief because of the ratings again, as we mentioned before. They also had the Parents Television Council file an insuit against The X Factor because of a contestant who dropped his pants. It was a very stupid segment on the show.
It was horrible.
It was just dumb. I wasn't offended. It was just dumb. Why they showed it, I don't know. But it's been a crazy week for The X Factor and American Idol. It'll be a long time before we see how this lawsuit is figured out. But I do have to mention a quote that I saw from Simon Cowell. I hadn't mentioned this before, but he had this quote where he said, quote, "You can't give someone an executive producer's title if they didn't executive produce the show," end quote. To which I say, apparently, Simon, you've never been to Hollywood, where people get executive producers, quotes, all the time without doing any work.
New Oscar campaigning rules. First, no bad-mouthing on Twitter.
Oh.
Yeah, I know. Sorry, Michael. You're going to have to keep it down to a dull roar. Second, yes, you can show movies as much as you want and throw a reception before the nominations come out. After that, you better behave. It's all an attempt by the Academy to rein in excessive campaigning, and it totally won't work. Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
It's a big whoop. Like you say, it's whack-a-mole. They change the rules to try and capture some new loophole that people have discovered, and then people find some new loophole to do something else.
Director Nikita Mikhalkov, I hope I just pronounced that right, is having a bad year. First, Burnt by the Sun 2, The Citadel. I don't know why I said it that way. Well, the sequel to his biggest critical and commercial hit was a total flop in Russia, pilloried by fans and critics. The sole good news was that the Russian committee that chooses the country's Oscar contender for Best Foreign Film picked it as their entry. But now the head of the committee is asking the director to withdraw the film on his own so they can submit something else, you know, one that's preferably good. Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
It's a big whoop. It's a tempest in a teapot. I don't know what Russia would put forward that might get the Oscar nomination. It's a terrible movie. I saw it at Cannes. I practically fell asleep. I think the only good news for Nikita Mikhalkov, who is like a big nationalist, is that Vladimir Putin, is going to run for president again. So we're back to having a dictator for life in Russia.
Every penny counts, especially in the hard-hit music industry. A new company called Digital Rights Corp has signed up some labels with the promise that it will track down people who are illegally downloading and get the person's ISP to send along a quote-unquote bill demanding $10 per infringement. They don't actually sue anyone, but believe merely sending a letter might scare up some cash or at least get the people to freak out and stop illegally downloading. Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
I think it's a big whoop. It's just another wrinkle in the attempt to fight off piracy. At first, I thought, this sounds kind of stupid and cheap, but you know what? They're not doing any legal proceeding, assuming they're not abusing any privacy rights and that they're actually finding people who are illegal downloading. Why not?
Right.
You know?
That's exactly what they're saying. Everything old is new again in Hollywood and Broadway. Universal is planning a new version of the classic gangster film Scarface, the 1932 classic later remade to overblown effect in the 1983 Al Pacino star, a movie as beloved in its way by rappers and gangsters as The Godfather. Elton John is mining his own life to create a feature film biopic using music from his career to tell his life story. John is teaming with Lee Hall, the man he made the smash hit musical Billy Elliot with. And director Barry Levinson is teaming up with Sheryl Crow to make a Broadway musical out of Diner. Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
It's all a big whoop. It's always been going on. There's nothing new. Nobody should think it's some shocking surprise. Art has always cannibalized its own to create new art. And most of the time it's bad, but sometimes it's good. Diner actually sounds interesting, though. Golly, if there was a Broadway musical that deserved the right to use old jukebox hits in the show, Diner would be the one. It's like if you make a Broadway version of American Graffiti, you're going to use those old hits. But I guess they want actual emotional songs that will push the story forward, and more power to them. I hope it works out.
Well, you hope they push the story forward and aren't like the Spider-Man songs that Bono and the Edge wrote, which don't push the story anywhere.
Exactly.
Well, that concludes Big Deal or Big Whoop for this week and moves us right along into Inside Baseball, where we analyze some of the headlines that have the entertainment industry buzzing. We'll explain what they mean for the business, and more importantly, how they affect you. Now, this week, we're going to be joined by Ryan Lawler, who writes for GigaOM, and he has spent the last 5 years covering business, technology, and telecom-related subjects for a variety of publications based in New York. Before joining GigaOM, he spent 2 years following online video and digital media trends at Contentinople. Prior to that, Ryan covered telecom infrastructure for Light Reading. He's someone I've wanted to have on the show for quite some time. Ryan, thank you for joining us.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Last week, you wrote a story on what's going on with Dish's Blockbuster, and we'll talk about that in a moment because
sure.
You've also been writing quite a lot about Netflix, which changed its pricing back in July, and then the past 2 weeks have been a roller coaster ride for Netflix, ending with them splitting their DVD business and changing the name of its DVD business to Quixtar and keeping streaming under the Netflix banner.
Right.
What is your opinion of what's gone on over the past 2 weeks, if you have one?
Well, no, of course I do. It's been an interesting couple of weeks, and an interesting couple of months, actually. When they first announced the pricing change, there were a lot of dissatisfied customers, a lot of people that were talking about quitting. And, you know, it's been one of those things where they have dealt with that for the past 2 months, and then it seemed like they actually amplified a lot of the disapproval with this latest news, which they announced, you know, ironically as part of an apology from Netflix CEO Reed Hastings. So yeah, they've decided to split the operations into a new brand and make it just about DVD. And you know, it's definitely an interesting move for Netflix.
Well, there was a blog post, I suppose, not an article, that Bill Gurley of Benchmark Capital, which is a Silicon venture capital firm.
Sure.
He wrote this blog post. I don't know if you saw it, but it was really, it kind of said, you know, that Reed Hastings, the CEO of Netflix, is kind of a good CEO, but that, you know, he really had no choice, that the original business model that Netflix operated under was really an old one. It was due to a 1908 Supreme Court ruling known as a first sale doctrine, in which anybody who buys a DVD can then rent it out. But that with streaming, that doesn't work that way.
Well, so the question there is, you know, just a perspective of, you know, what they could do operationally versus what they could do as a brand. And operationally, when they first announced the price increase or the pricing change 2 months ago back in July, you know, they had already decided, or they had already announced, that they were going to be operating streaming separately from DVD. And so that's not a huge change. And to be honest, because they were doing things that way, personally, I'm not sure that really comes into play, since the businesses were already separate. What's happening now is much more radical from an organizational standpoint, because they're asking consumers to have different accounts. They're asking them to go to different websites. Ratings won't carry over from, you know, the Netflix site to the Quixtar site, and vice versa. They'll have, you know, two different companies to have credit cards on file with. So it's actually not a very consumer-friendly option what they've done.
So is this just a panic response on their part to how customers reacted, and that's not very well thought out, or what's the drive behind this?
Well, I think that what's really happening is, you know, and Reed Hastings alludes to this in his post, is that the world is littered with companies that did one thing well and then didn't move quickly enough to transition the business to deal with, you know, with new business models, or to, you know, change the way they operate. And so I think that, you know, making Quixtar its own company is Netflix's way of separating things out and actually drawing a fine line between, you know, streaming and DVD, and in so doing, hopefully being able to focus more effectively on both sides of the business.
Yeah, I thought it was interesting what Bill Gurley was talking about, how, you know, with DVDs, if somebody, one of Netflix's customers, didn't watch a DVD in a given month, it was fine. They collected the $12 or however much they were collecting from that user, and it didn't matter. They didn't have to pay any of that out. However, with digital streaming, they were having to pay for every single subscriber, and that the deals they cut originally for streaming were changing to one that was more of like a profit participation or a revenue share, just like the cable business, I suppose, where the studios and the networks get a percentage or dollar per customer per month.
Yeah, I'm not really sure that that's actually what's happening here. I know that, you know, that's probably how some companies want things to operate. I think that was a sticking point between Netflix and Starz when Starz decided that they weren't able to, or they weren't going to negotiate further to have their content on Netflix. I believe that part of the disagreement was that they were asking for more of a subscription type fee. But Netflix CFO David Weld, he had spoken at a conference last week. I believe that, I forget which one it was, to be honest, but he had said something along the lines of, doing upfront licensing fees is what they've always done. There's a precedent in it for subscription cable networks, where they're not, when they pay for the license, they're not paying for the number of subscribers they have. They're paying, you know, an upfront flat fee. And so I don't necessarily know that that's the model that Netflix is going to go towards on a large scale. So I mean, maybe this provides them a little bit more flexibility to negotiate in that way. I just don't think that they have a lot of interest in striking those types of deals.
Well, we saw a lot of bad reporting about what happened to Netflix in the last week or two. All the newspapers and magazines said, oh, they've lost 1 million customers, when in fact what had happened was that Netflix revised an estimate of how many customers, subscribers they expected to have at the end of the third quarter, which is certainly not the same thing.
And, right. And I mean, let's be clear about that. You know, they were offering what was their best guess based upon customer feedback and, you know, the number of subscribers that use each service. So they were kind of in uncharted territory. You know, they're basically trying to guess at, you know, how consumers would use a separated service like this. And, you know, it shouldn't be that big of a surprise that they were a little bit off, since they were changing the pricing so dramatically and changing the service offering so dramatically. I think it was just a question of, you know, that revised forecast was just one more thing thrown on top of the news that Starz wasn't coming back, and general, you know, reaction to the rate hike. It just was one thing after another, and you know, Wall Street hasn't responded favorably to any of this news.
But at worst, it meant that growth was slowing. It didn't mean that a million people had cut off their credit card and said, I don't want to go to Netflix anymore. So
right,
it was
right.
Sort of inaccurate. The other thing that wasn't covered well was if you have 24 million people instead of 25 million, which means you've lost about 5% of your customers, but you've done at the same time, you've increased revenue by, you know, potentially up to 60%. Well, that's okay.
Yeah. I mean, the way that this is going to be looked at in the future is, you know, the revenue isn't necessarily going to be increased by 60%, but, you know, now they've separated people into buckets where they have, you know, quote unquote, revenue generating units. And so when you look at cable as an example, that's an industry where, you know, the number of actual video subscribers for Comcast has been falling over the last, you know, several quarters, over the last several years. But they actually have more revenue generating units because they have more people signing up for broadband. They have more people signing up for digital phone. And so in the aggregate, they're actually getting more money per subscriber, even though they're losing subscribers in one business or another. And I think that that's the way that Netflix is going to start looking at its business, as opposed to just, you know, counting every $10 subscriber at the same rate.
But now let's talk about that for a second. We got a lot of emails saying that, you know, the problem is that, yeah, okay, revenues might be going up 60%, but you're going to have fewer customers and thus more of a chance for, you know, failure if a certain percentage, a large percentage of those customers all decide to move at the same time. You'll have fewer people that can leave before you're in the red.
Right, right. Well, I mean, I don't think that that's necessarily going to be an issue. I do think that the way that they handled, I mean, obviously the big problem around all of this is that the PR was very bad. They didn't communicate this well either when they first announced the price increase or, you know, the separation of the DVD and streaming businesses. And when they announced this whole new brand, they handled that poorly as well. So all along, I mean, they've done a very bad job of reaching out to the community and, you know, sort of making sure that, you know, this isn't the sort of message that you can relay to customers and expect them to be happy, but at least, you know, you can try to keep them from being really pissed off.
Right. I mean, do you think that they've damaged their brand equity? I mean, they've had really good brand equity. People really like them. Do you think that has now been damaged?
Oh, for sure. For sure. It's one of those things where, you know, they were sort of in this virtuous cycle, right, where quarter after quarter, more people showed up basically via positive word of mouth. I mean, they were, you know, consistently one of the top brands in terms of, you know, customer approval rating over the last several years. And that has had the effect of really dramatically lowering their, you know, customer acquisition costs. And so, you know, when you move from a place where people hear good word of mouth about your service, and that naturally gets them to sign up, to a place where, you know, all anyone reads about Netflix is, you know, how they raise prices and their, you know, they haven't communicated with their customers very well. And by the way, now they're going to have separate billing relationships for each of their services. I mean, it's just a very, very consumer unfriendly way of doing business. And I think that, you know, in part, the revised numbers are reflect a slowdown in what they expect, but it also reflects people leaving. And so they're going to have to work even harder and probably spend more on marketing and building goodwill to get those people back and to get more people signed up. So I expect in the next few quarters, you're going to see those customer acquisition costs increase pretty dramatically as they double down on marketing and try to get people back and to try to get more people signed up.
The main thing I get frustrated by, though, is the people who own the libraries, the studios that have TV shows and films, you know, in their catalog. I think they're overvaluing them in a sense, because I think they should appreciate that places like Netflix and Hulu and perhaps YouTube and some others are really valuable entry points for people to access their product. Everybody seems to think that if they've got a couple hundred hours of footage that they can go online, set up a site, get people to subscribe. I mean, there's a company called Acorn, which specializes in British television. They have about a couple hundred hours of programming, and they have like a monthly fee and a thing. You're going to like, I think you're crazy. You know, come on. I don't want to have to go to the web and search through 800 websites to figure out where the show I want to watch is residing. So to me, it makes sense to partner with Netflix and Amazon and YouTube and Hulu and maybe do a revenue sharing thing rather than thinking you can just charge them through the roof and or set up your own system and think everybody's going to come to you.
Right. Well, I mean, I think that the big picture or the big problem right now is we haven't reached an equilibrium. And it's going to be a long time before we reach an equilibrium between the amount of money that they can, that the content owners can expect from, you know, digital distribution as opposed to, you know, what they get either, you know, if it's a film studio from, you know, DVD sales, which are declining, or if it's a TV broadcaster, what they're getting in terms of advertising. And so I think in both cases, the problem that the studios and the problem that the networks face is, you know, they're offering up this content on an unlimited basis for $8 a month at the same time that, you know, they're getting paid a heck of a lot more in terms of advertising or movie sales or DVD sales. And so there's no real incentive right now for them to cannibalize their own business, knowing that if somebody's going to watch something on Hulu, they might not watch it when they're able to monetize it the best, which is, you know, during the live broadcast when, you know, the major brands advertise.
Well, just to that point, you know, there just yesterday, I think, or last night, it was announced that DreamWorks Animation and Netflix have reached a deal, and starting in 2013, Netflix will be streaming, you know, DreamWorks animated movies. Right. And they're saying, okay, it'll be $30 million per picture to DreamWorks over an unspecified number of years. We now know that it's through 2016. Right. And those are output deals. So a studio will sign those with different companies. Obviously, Disney and Sony have signed that with Starz, and that's where their films go. Previously, DreamWorks Animation had a similar deal with HBO, and that was worth $20 million a picture, and that's where their films went. And now Netflix is creeping into this business, and they're competing with the HBOs of the world in that window. And what I mean by that is you have theatrical, so, you know, when something is first airs on television or when it is in a movie theater, you then have this pay TV window, so that's where HBO and Cinemax and Showtime, etc., get the film for an exclusive period of time. Then you have broadcast, you know, DVD and broadcast television, which, you know, depending on who you ask, those times overlap, but not by much. And so Netflix is kind of creeping into the DVD and pay TV window, and they're going to have some problems negotiating with the studios and networks in that area, aren't they?
I think that, you know, I think that they're doing just fine for right now. I mean, it's just a question of what you expect Netflix to be. Netflix isn't going to be HBO right away. They're not going to be Starz or Cinemax right away or Showtime. What they do very well, I mean, they're rerun TV. You know, this is, Netflix is what TBS or TNT or, you know, AMC, what any of these, you know, basic cable companies were maybe 15 years ago, where pretty much all of the content that they had was syndicated. And right now, Netflix is, to a certain extent, getting into, you know, original programming through their House of Cards deal. You know, I think that to the extent that they don't have everything, you know, there's a whole bunch of cable channels that did just okay doing reruns of Seinfeld and MASH and Cheers over the course of the last several decades. So,
but they weren't, you know, charging us $8 or $9 per month to do so.
You were paying $30 or $60 for your cable bill.
Right.
Right. Right. So I think that, you know, as it operates in the long tail, I think Netflix is going to do just fine. You know, something like over half of all of the movies that of all the streaming hours that people watch happen based on recommendations that they present. You know, the impact of having those big name titles like the Starz library when it's less than, you know, 8 or 10% of all viewing hours. I think that, you know, to the extent that they can keep customers happy on the pricing side of things, they'll be just fine with the content. So when Starz leaves, when some big content provider decides not to renew, when Showtime doesn't renew its shows that are still on air, and when those types of things happen, I think that that gets overblown based upon, you know, relative to the amount of time that actually people spend watching those titles.
Well, now, they do have competitors, and we've mentioned some of them. Amazon is one of them with their Prime Video offering, and just this morning it was announced that Fox, for their TV shows like X-Files and Ally McBeal and 24 and Arrested Development and Buffy the Vampire Slayer, and for the first time, The Wonder Years, they mm-hmm. have signed a deal with Amazon, the library of up to 11,000 movies and TV shows. You know, that's now not available to Netflix. And then you have someone like Dish Networks coming in with Blockbuster and their Movie Pass, which was announced last week, and everybody thought it was going to be a Netflix killer. You don't believe it is going to be a Netflix killer. Why is that?
Well, not in the way that it was, you know, first announced. Just to back up and to let people know, you know, Blockbuster Movie Pass, it's a combined DVD rental and streaming package. There's, I think, 5,000 titles for streaming. There's 100,000 DVDs, which is pretty much the same as the Netflix library. And it costs $10 a month. But the catch is, you know, that you can really only access it if you're a Dish Network subscriber. And so when I say that it's not a Netflix killer, you know, prior to this announcement, as soon as people saw that Dish Network was going to be making some announcement in San Francisco and ran with the timeline or with the tagline, a stream come true or whatever it was, you know, everybody sort of jumped on the bandwagon and said, you know, this is going to be Dish's Blockbuster streaming solution. And, you know, Netflix has had a lot of bad news. Maybe people jump ship. But what this requires you to do is to also be a Dish subscriber. So I'm not sure how many people are going to jump ship to pay $10 a month for this offering, which I tend to think is not as good as Netflix to start with, but also have to pay, you know, $40 a month for a Dish subscription on top of that. I mean, the entire point is that, you know, if you have Netflix and you're using that either to supplement or in place of a cable subscription, the last thing you're going to do is jump to satellite and pay an additional $40 on top of what you're getting with Netflix. So I just, that's why I don't think it's a Netflix killer.
Right. Now, obviously, this is a space that's going to be changing quite rapidly and have a lot of news over the next couple of months or a couple of years, really, when you think about it. And I appreciate you taking the time to kind of come on and try and explain it to us.
Yeah, sure. You know, it's always fun for me to talk about these types of things. I'm happy you had me.
Well, and where can we find your work? Certainly at GigaOhm, and is that
right,
GigaOhm?
Right. So GigaOhm.com/video is where most of my stories appear. And, you know, I write about all this stuff, Netflix and Hulu and Blockbuster. So it's a lot of fun for me. It's a fun space, and, you know, it's changing so rapidly that there's always something new and interesting happening.
And you're also on Twitter,
Yeah, Twitter at just my name, Ryan Lawler, RyanLawler. It's my handle.
Well, thank you very much for taking the time to join us. I certainly hope you can join us again in the future.
Yep. Thanks a lot. Thanks for having me.
Thank you.
All right.
Bye.
Well, that was nice of him to join us.
Yes. As I said, I've wanted to have Ryan on for quite some time. His stories on GigaOm are great.
Well, I have to check them out. I haven't been there before. I have to say that I should have commented about the DreamWorks animation deal. I understand why it was so much because they were cutting out pay cable. You know, the movies were going to be available only through Netflix.
Yeah.
But frankly, they've only got 22 movies.
Right. I know. That's why I thought, is this a big deal? It's not really that interesting.
And they're paying $30 million. I guess it's $30 million over 3 years per movie.
For future movies, probably.
Well, including, yes, but for 3 years through 2016, they'll only have one or two movies a year in DreamWorks Animation, you know,
right,
over the next 3 years. So you're talking about $10 million a year for the rights to stream Spirit, Stallion of the Cimarron, Sinbad, Legend of the Seven Seas, The Road to El Dorado, Flushed Away.
Are you trying to say that their movies might not be as...
No, they have some hits, but I mean, there's only 22 of them. And you're paying $10 million for every single one. You're paying $220 million a year for 22 movies. That seems like a lot of money.
Yes, it does.
I mean, I would say you go through your pay cable and then we'll take them for less. I mean, it just seems like too much money for movies that are, 10, 15 years old.
Yeah, and I think really the big problem and one I didn't really want to get into with Ryan because, he has to do other things other than talk to us, was really that the industry needs to begin to change the way their licensing works and the different windows. They're going to have to change.
If I had a library, I'd say, I like your business deal. Okay, I'll take a cut of the profits from Hulu, take a cut of the profits from Netflix, take a cut of profits from YouTube and one other place, and offer them myself, perhaps as well, through my cable company, wherever it might be, and let the consumer decide where they want to go. I'm going to make money anyway. A reasonable price, make cut of the profits. I don't care where they go.
Right, but if you're HBO, you want to lock up the content, so you turn around and say, I will give you some ridiculous amount of money, like $10, $20, $30 million for each film.
Well, HBO is different because that's only for a certain period.
Right.
We're not talking about HBO. We're talking about, the movie's gone. It's gone through the cycle. We're saying this movie's gone. I'm saying you put it out, it goes to theater, DVD, HBO, basic cable, and now it's in your library. What are you doing with those movies? I'm not talking about a new film that's just hitting the stores. I'm not going to cut any part of the revenue stream out, frankly.
Oh, so you're talking about the long
HBO,
tail.
Of course, yeah. HBO has its exclusive period, but we're talking about 10, 12-year-old movies from DreamWorks. We're talking about, Chicken Run that came out in 2000. It's an 11-year-old movie. It's already gone through the cycle. So now what are you doing with that film? I'm seeing your catalog,
okay,
the back catalog. Why not make it available to all the players you think are doing a good job and get a cut of the profits and make it more reasonable? To make an exclusive deal with one place or another place and try and overcharge, to me, it's, you're just screwing yourself over. Because if I have to figure out where to find a Universal movie, I have to remember, that DVD is available only at Kmart, and this DVD is only available at Walmart, and the other DVD is only available at Amazon. That pisses me off.
Yes, no, I agree.
Same thing is going to happen with your catalog. It's less valuable if people can't find it.
Well, that's what Michael thinks. We, of course, always want to know what you think. And you can email us at dirt@showbizsandbox.com. And that's exactly what, we received a lot of emails regarding our dispute over whether Nikki Fink was breaking the law or not. And I picked one out that seemed to be the most concise and most expert out of them. And you'll see why. Michael, do you want to
take this? So this is the winner.
This is the winner of the, telling us whether...
This is the winner of explaining law to two morons who don't know anything about the law.
Pretty much, yeah.
Yes. The letter says, hello, kids. In discussing Nikki Fink's dispute with The Hollywood Reporter on episode 118, you sparred over whether Deadline Hollywood's actions were against the law. Speaking as a lawyer, that, as with all legal matters, it can be tricky and truly depends on the circumstances. If Deadline employees or Ms. Fink were making negative comments about The Hollywood Reporter to potential customers, whether publicly or privately, that would likely fall under trade libel. Trade libel is the purposeful and intentional disparagement of the quality of a specific property, the goods and services sold by that property, or the character of the business entity. The disparagement, as it is called in such instances, can come in any form of false statement, whether in writing or spoken, and there must be measurable fiscal and pecuniary damages to any plaintiff wishing to file a trade libel lawsuit. In the United States, trade libel is not a criminal act, so technically it is not against the law as defined during your conversation. However, it is actionable through a civil action suit filed by one party against another. The key difference is that this type of law is not necessarily written by legislators or government officials, but rather defined by precedent and what is known as tort law. I should mention that I am oversimplifying this definition, but I hope you get the picture. As Sperling stated, Ms. Fink was in no danger of being thrown in jail for her actions. But as Michael pointed out, she is putting Deadline Hollywood and the company that owns them in the kind of legal jeopardy that ends careers. In closing, I'd like to compliment both of you on putting together a show which has remained informative and interesting, filling me in on a week's worth of news that I'm not always able to keep up with. Best wishes, Anthony C., New York, New York.
I noticed he didn't add his last name there.
Well, it just says C.
Yeah, no. No, I mean, he didn't...
Oh, he didn't. Oh,
yeah,
okay.
He didn't.
Yes. Well, thanks for writing and clearing that up. I guess Sproul and I were both right in a way. That's a nice change of pace.
Yeah, I agree. But yeah, I mean, this was, of course, for those who didn't listen to episode 118, Nikki Fink had been making disparaging remarks about the Hollywood Reporter. The Hollywood Reporter sent a letter and hijinks ensued.
And now Anthony has explained to us better the difference between what's legal and illegal, what can get you thrown into jail and what can just cost you a lot of money.
Right. And you know what doesn't cost any money?
What?
Nor can it get you thrown into jail. If you
Necessarily.
If you email us, dirt@showbizsandbox.com, or you can even leave us a voicemail. The number to call is 888-567-SAND. That's 888-567-7263. You can subscribe to our podcast in the iTunes store or the Zune marketplace or even your RSS reader. You can follow us on Twitter. Our username is @ShowbizSandbox. We're even on Facebook under the same name, Showbiz Sandbox. Now, all of those links, as well as links to all of the stories we've discussed during today's episode, can be found on showbizsandbox.com. That is our website. Again, that's showbizsandbox.com. We'll also place links to Ryan Lawler's work. I'd like to thank him for joining us to talk about Netflix and Dish Network's announcement. The music that you hear at the beginning and end of each show is by the popular indie rock group MGMT. They can
They're going to be on television. Hold on one second.
What?
I beg your pardon. Yeah. They got a show coming up. They are on the air. They're on Jimmy Fallon Wednesday night, Thursday morning. So make sure you check in. One of our favorite bands, and we want to support them whenever possible. They'll be on the Jimmy Fallon show late Wednesday night, early Thursday morning this week.
That's right. And after you catch them there, you can also go to MySpace and find them or their website, whoismgmt.com. You can find Michael at michaelgiltz.com. That's his website where all of his work can be found. Some of my writing can be found on Celluloid Junkie. And until next week, play nice.